to hear can easily understand.
Just because it's late doesn't mean we're done yet.
And the shirt's up. That's a pen.
And the quarterback, you kidding me, coach?
There's plenty more hits to dish out.
Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he? Look at that. He hit the f***ing ball. That gets a free steak.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5, presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical Rx, by Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology, and by BetUS, the original online sportsbook. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's Patrick Creighton.
This is the only live and local evening sports radio show in the city of Houston. Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. Patrick Creighton with you. 713-780-3776. 713-780-ESPN. On the HRMP listener line, on the text line, on X, Twitter, at PCreighton1. Brian McDonald on the other side of the glass at the Master Controls, at Sacked by BMAC on the X, Twitter. On the Twitch stream, twitch.tv/ESPN975, ESPN975.com, ESPN975 app. Tell Google, tell Alexa, play ESPN975 and take us with you everywhere you go. You know you'll want to. Now, we just heard from Jim Crane. Thank Dusty. Gave Dusty all the flowers. Totally expected all that. Then you heard him say, hey, you know, we just started, you know, the search today. And it's going to be he and Dana Brown searching for the new manager, and by omission, not other people, not named Jim Crane or Dana Brown, as for whatever reason, people seem to think that Jeff Bagwell is like Jim Crane's Jack Easterby, and he's got these mind powers, and he tells Jim Crane what to do. Wrong. If you know anything about Jim Crane, nobody tells him what to do. Jim Crane is very much his own man. Jeff Bagwell is more an ambassador of Jim Crane. All right, it is much more Jeff Bagwell giving the nod of approval to whatever Jim Crane says than Jeff Bagwell telling Jim Crane than Jim Crane giving a nod of approval. Jim Crane rules the roost. Let's be very clear about that. Jim Crane rules the roost, and he doesn't rule it with kid gloves. He rolls it very firmly, and when he has to put an iron fist on, he does. That man is not the successful person he is because other people tell him what to do. Wrong. Backwards. This comment from Jim Crane after he talked about the search and just getting started, I thought was a little bit more telling. Here is more from Jim Crane, who does not expect this managerial search to drag on very long.
Really, today is about Dusty. We'll get back to you on what's going to happen next. But, Dana's done a great job so far. And, you know, we've got things really running well in the back office. And so I don't think it'll take us very long to find someone that will fit in well with us. But right now, congratulations to Dusty. And, again, thank you very much.
Now, if you put those two pieces together, let me tell you what he really said. Dusty Baker has been working on one-year contracts. They always had a short list because they knew after any season, it could be the last one. They've always had a short list. Dana took this job and made a short list. Joe Espada, maybe Alex Cintron, already on a short list. I mean, it did seem like last offseason, Joe Espada, who looked like he was about to accept a managerial job, suddenly dropped out of the race, probably because there was a promise made of, hey, you know, Dusty's not going to manage forever, and you're our guy in waiting.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you believe what Dusty said in one of the earlier clips we played, where he talked about pretty much making this decision last winter, or at least starting to think this was going to be his decision last winter.
I felt the context of what he said was, hey, we just won. We're going to try to win again. If we don't win, I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
But you know, win again, then maybe I'll do another year. I think he would have continued to manage as long as they kept that winning.
I agree.
And then when they didn't win, okay, you know what, I'm done.
I agree.
And it's a grind.
But I took, and then I'm going along with you there, because I do think what Jim Crane said there about it's not going to take long. I mean, what wouldn't take long? Well, maybe hiring the guy that's already been under Dusty for the last few seasons.
Who was under AJ Hinch before that.
Exactly. I mean, if any move is not going to take long, it certainly would be Joe Espada. So that certainly, while I wouldn't say it's 100% certainty, okay, Joe Espada is the number one candidate, I took that quote as saying Joe Espada is our number one candidate.
I think Joe Espada, if he's not the number one candidate, he's 1A.
Who would even be over him at this point?
I don't know over him, but maybe on par could be Walt Weiss. Yeah. Walt Weiss is the Braves coach.
Isn't he going to the Mets, though?
That's Craig Counsell.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, sorry. You're right.
Walt Weiss is the Braves bench coach. He's been there since 2018. Obviously, Dana knows him.
Connections with Dana Brown. Yeah.
He obviously is part of a system that Dana wants implemented here, where the GM and the manager are aligned and there is a cooperative foundation, as opposed to the crotchety old manager who tells you to, you know, where to stick it when you try to give him any input. When you have a new GM who comes in, that new GM always wants to hire their guys. That new GM always wants to put their stamp on the organization. James Click never really got to do that. And Dana is not going to make the same mistakes relationship-wise with the owner that James Click made. James Click was put into a situation where the team was in scandal, the team was in turmoil, they had just gotten hammered for fines, they had just lost a truckload of draft picks, and he was kind of there to steady a ship that was listing. I think James Click did a good job. He didn't do a phenomenal job. But he did a very good job. He kept the boat afloat, kept it in the right direction, and kept them winning. Dana now is going to have a little bit different responsibility in that not only he's not just coming here to keep the ship going in the right direction, he's got to do upgrades.
Not only does he have to do upgrades, I think he is more so than Click tasked with keeping this winning window open. Because, I mean, when you look ahead on this roster with Bregman and Altuve, Kyle Tucker, there's some expiring Fromber. Next two or three seasons, there are some big-time expiring contracts to where if they're not handled correctly, especially since the minor league system doesn't have a lot of top-level talent ready to come up immediately. I mean, the Astros' window to win, if those situations aren't handled correctly, could close quicker than any of us really wanted to.
And that's what I mean by he's got to do upgrades.
Yeah.
Because the Astros' MO has been, outside of Jose Altuve, if you're not signing a deal that's team-friendly, you're not signing a deal. They don't go on these big, long-term deals. Altuve still has the longest deal. Well, longest, most money combined.
Yeah, he was over $200 million. I believe Bregman was right at $100 million.
So
and Bregman, then Jordan was in the neighborhood of that as well.
Bregman's total deal, including arbitration, et cetera, was 6 years at $115 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Altuve was 7 years at $163.5 million. I'm sorry, Bregman was 5 years at $100 million. Jordan is $6 and $115 million.
There you go. Okay.
You know, McCullers is $5 and $85 million.
Which is a team,
discount.
Obviously, with the injury history now, it doesn't look as friendly, but at the time, it certainly was below market, or at least a team-friendly deal.
Christian Javier is, you know, ate up some extension, ate up some arbitration, 5 years, $64 million. You know, Abreu got $3 and $58.5 million because people forget a lot of teams were interested in Jose Abreu. There were only three, quote, above mid first baseman on the market. It was Abreu, it was Josh Bell,
Rizzo,
and it was Anthony Rizzo.
Yeah.
Anthony Rizzo was the Astros' first choice, but he's re-signed with the Yankees right away. There were six teams that were all in on Jose Abreu. So they went the extra year to lock the deal in. When Jose Abreu got signed, every single person in the city said they got their guy. They might have given him an extra year, but they got their guy. Every single flipping person. The fact that he got off to a bad start, We found out later on he was dealing with a back injury all season long. The Astros, of course, never talk about injuries until they absolutely have to. People get on Jeff Bagwell, the back of the baseball card defense. What exactly did you expect Jeff Bagwell to say? He sucks. We should get rid of him. I mean, he's an ambassador of the team. He's a former player. He's a Hall of Famer. He is not going to throw another incredibly respected player under the bus. Certainly not on freaking TV. If you thought Jeff Bagwell was going to do anything other than defend Jose Abreu, you're a friggin' idiot. You've no idea how baseball works. They weren't going to throw. He signed for 2 more years. They needed him to turn it around. And also, what is baseball if not the law of averages? Guys generally, like 85% of their career, perform to roughly 15% of what their career numbers are. Every now and then, a guy has a really bad year. Every now and then, a guy has a really amazing, Brady Anderson year.
Well, Brady was enhanced.
But for the most part, guys perform within 20% of their career norms.
Yeah, and specifically to kind of return into the mean, like you mentioned there, I mean, guys will go through stretches where they're 0 for 20, and then next month you have a 12 for 16 stretch. And
look
then
at Altuve is the perfect example.
Right, and then over the balance, it evens out to wherever their career numbers are.
But you know what? Once Abreu went on the IL and got treatment for this back injury, he came back. Oh, wow, look, the power's back.
Yeah, you know, the season with 90 on RBI.
In what, 18 homers?
Obviously the homers are still a little bit low, but I mean, 90 RBI? I mean, if you tell me before the season, okay, the Astros just signed a first baseman, I'm guaranteeing you 90 RBI. Okay, sure, I'll sign up for that.
The homers overall were low, but he picked them up after he came off the IL. Oh, and look at the postseason, just banging homers there, too.
Yeah, certainly in the series against Minnesota, for
you know,
sure.
You certainly feel good about Abreu coming in next year with the power being back. You know, go have his back treated in the offseason so he comes in, he's fully healthy, and he's ready to rip.
Well, not only the Minnesota, I mean, we just obviously mentioned the playoffs, the Minnesota series. I mean, don't forget, coming into that last series of the season against the Arizona Diamondbacks, the World Series-bound Arizona Diamondbacks, the Astros won one game 2-1 and one game 1-0. All three of those runs in those two games driven in by Jose Abreu.
Yeah, Abreu.
They don't win that series. They don't make the playoffs without Jose Abreu.
Abreu wound up being very important for them in September and October, and that's why you got him.
Yeah, the series that won them the division was won by Jose Abreu.
You know, I mean,
along with the pitcher.
And I'm not trying to yay one guy, boo the other guy, but Jose Abreu smoking hot end of September, October. Kyle Tucker cold as ice end of September, October. You needed Tucker all year long, but Tuck died in the postseason.
Yeah, he was awful. He might have been even worse than Jose Altuve was last season until the World Series.
And that's not saying, hey, don't pay Tucker or anything. It's just baseball.
But it's a sport of runs.
It is. It really is. And it's a sport of runs. It's
streaks.
A sport of cycles.
Yeah.
You go on hot streaks, cold streaks. Tuck happened to hit a cold streak at the worst time. Guys hit cold streaks. That is baseball. It's not like, oh, this guy sucks. Oh, he can't handle the pressure. Tuck has performed under pressure plenty of times. Just this year, he was cold.
Yeah, I know he had at least one home run in last year's World Series. It's not like he's never performed under the brightest lights.
You know, but we've been talking about how the Astros have a lot of, like, the Astros have $195.5 million in committed salaries right now for 2024 before they, finalize all their arbitration numbers, right? For 2025, that number is $90 million less. There's a lot of money for 2025 that, like, Bregman's a free agent for 2025. Altuve, Graveman is a free agent in 2025. You're going to have Pena hits arbitration in 2025. Jake Myers hits arbitration in 2025. Brian Abreu hits arbitration this year, so he'll be Arb 2. Louis Garcia will be Arb 2. Chazzy will be Arb 2. Dubon will be Arb 3 unless he's deemed a Super 2. Urquidy will be Arb 3. Fromber, they will probably have had to have signed or let go because he's Arb 3 this year unless he's deemed a Super 2. And then Tucker would be in his final year of arbitration, 2025 as well. They've made a habit of not re-signing. Like, if guys want the big money, Springer, Keuchel, Cole, Correa, they just keep letting them walk.
Yeah.
All right, they let Fromber walk. They let Tucker walk. I don't know they necessarily have the pieces to just replace those guys.
Yeah, not to be an alarmist, not to sound, sound the alarm, but 2026 could look a lot different than what we're used to seeing since 2017, depending on the moves Dana Brown. I mean, basically every piece of what we know now know, or as the core of this Astros team, could basically be gone by 2026, depending on what Dana Brown does.
Alex Bregman is going to make $30.5 million next season.
Yeah.
And
his deal had like an escalation where like the first part
of it. Bought out some of his arbitration years.
Right.
But do you think he's going to want to take a pay cut?
No, of course not.
He's going to be looking for $35 million plus a year.
And I mean, depending on the amount of years, I wouldn't be willing to pay him $35 million a year. Unless we're talking about a very short term deal.
Another interesting thing, right? Ryan Pressly, who is now 35, but Pressly is one of the best closers in the league, and he is the best closer in the postseason in the league. He makes $14 million next year. He has a $14 million mutual option for 2025. I would expect that at least one of those two parties is not going to pick that up.
Yeah. So he'd be 36 at that point?
He'd be 36 and looking for a deal.
He's looking for his final big cash. Yeah, he's looking for his last big contract.
Probably a three-year deal type of thing. But he's a pitcher. And Pressly hasn't had any kind of major injury. And he's not a guy who goes up there throwing 99 miles an hour.
Right.
His best pitch is a breaking ball. So, you know, the idea of, you know, will Pressly age well? Probably will. But I think when you get to that point at 36 years old, you're probably looking to turn over the closer role to Brian Abreu.
Especially depending on what the other moves Dana Brown makes. If this is starting to look like they may take a year or two step back to then go forward and kind of reset the roster, then I don't think in that scenario they would want to pay a 36-year-old closer top of the market money.
But think about the bullpen right now, right? For 2025, Pressly could be out. Neris is probably out this year.
He's a free agent now, yeah.
Because he could opt out. He's got a player option. He's probably going to opt out and go sign a big contract. Graveman would be a free agent. So, like,
Maton and Stanek are free agents this year.
Yeah, and I don't think Stanek's coming back. I think Maton might be back at the right number.
I'm just saying. I mean, a large majority of this bullpen would be gone.
And the bullpen's turnover. There is no more volatile position in baseball than a relief pitcher. That is the one position group where you can have large fluctuations year over year because they small sample size. And one bad two-week stretch for a reliever could be the difference between a 2 ERA and a 5 ERA.
Look what happened to David Robertson after the trade to Miami.
Oh, he collapsed. He got rocked. But he had a 2 ERA for the Mets.
Yeah, he was great for the Mets, and as soon as they traded to Miami, he fell apart. Yeah, but again, small sample size.
He hit a slump. For like a 10-inning stretch, he hit a slump. And he wound up – but like, that's a guy, if the Astros go out and say, hey, you know what, David Robertson, here's $8 million, come pitch for us, I'm all on board with that. He's a really good guy to have as like, in a setup type of role. All right, coming up next, we will play a little game called Five Reasons. We'll get to that on the other side next.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Pitter patter.
It's a hard life picking stones and pulling teats, but sure as God's got sandals, it beats fighting dudes with treasure trails.
This is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5, presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical RX, by Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology, and by BetUS, the original online sportsbook for the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Patrick Creighton.
So, try a new segment here. It's called Five Reasons. BMAC and I were talking about this earlier today. This is actually BMAC's idea. I liked it, so we're going to go with it. We're going to come up with some info. BMAC's going to hit me with some reasons for why or why something should or shouldn't happen. And we're going to decide if we like it or not. So we're going to turn over the microphone Oh, this is dangerous. We're going to turn over the microphone.
Oh, it's
Brian
9:24 at night. It's all right. Yeah, as you said, I'm going to present some reasons why something will happen, specifically five, unless we've realized this takes too long. Then it might become three reasons why. And you'll tell me if you buy into this or not as a reason why this will happen. So today's topic, five reasons why the Texans will beat the Carolina Panthers on Sunday. All right, first one up. First reason, Bryce Young has not had a good rookie season, and the numbers behind their 0-6 start and his poor play are pretty alarming and certainly leaning towards showing that the Texans got the better of the two quarterbacks, C.J. Stroud. Right now, through the first six games, obviously Bryce Young didn't miss one game, but he is 23rd in completion percentage, 27th in passing yards per game, 29th in quarterback rating, 32nd in QBR, and he's 31st in net yards per pass attempt. I don't believe Bryce Young is good enough to beat the Houston Texans on Sunday.
Right this second, he is not. Look, I think Bryce Young will eventually be a better-than-average quarterback with a chance to be a really good quarterback. But the Carolina Panthers do not have the people around him for him to be successful right now. Offensive line is not very good. Their running game is not very good. I mean, Miles Sanders is getting benched. He got benched through their last game. Was it 2 weeks ago where he got sat?
He also got hurt.
Their wide receivers, you know, Adam Thielen's their best receiver. He's 150 years old. They haven't really found the magic with DJ Chark. Now, I think DJ Chark can be a pretty good receiver. They just haven't found the magic. Not necessarily big on Lav Chanot or Jonathan Mingo. I think that their system, the offense they're running, isn't really taking advantage of the things that Bryce Young does best. And I think it's important that, you know, if Frank Reich's going to turn over the play calling duties, that might actually be better for the Carolina Panthers. But right this second, no, Bryce Young's not good enough to beat that.
All right, we're going to piggyback a little bit because two of the things you mentioned are two of the next things on my list here.
Oh, I was cheating. I was Kreskening. I can read the mind.
So next on the list.
Four of hearts.
Huh?
Four of hearts?
Actually, eight of spades. I'm sorry, ace of spades. Shout out to Lemmy.
You don't look like Motorhead.
Yeah, shout out to Lemmy. So Adam Thielen, the next reason on the list, and it's not because of Adam Thielen himself. He's been great. He's especially if you're playing fantasy football, my God, if you're in a PPR league, Adam Thielen has been one of the best late round
catches.
Yes, my goodness, he's been amazing. So he's been great, but their next best wide receiver in yards per game, you mentioned him, DJ Chark. His catch percentage is under 50%. The third guy in yards per game from the wide receiver position is rookie Jonathan Mingo, who is at 51% for his catch percentage. As you said, Bryce Young just has no weapons around him. I don't believe this wide receiver core, even with the Texans' injuries in the secondary with Stingley, can really hurt the Texans this week.
Now, Adam Fields got 509 yards receiving, and nobody else on the team is at 200.
Yeah, it's stop Thielen and you stop their passing game.
You know, and you know the running game. Chuba Hubbard has more yards than Miles Sanders, and they have not really utilized Sanders in the passing game. He's got,
which is disappointing because especially as someone who had Miles Sanders in fantasy, and I'll go ahead and piggyback this on because the next one on the list, Miles Sanders, their big free agent signing a running back. He's averaging 3.1 yards per carry, 3.1, and he ranks dead last, which is 41st among qualified running backs, in rushing success rate.
He also has 15 catches for 81 yards.
Yeah, that was something they talked about. That was something they talked about in the offseason, about wanting to get him involved in the passing game, and certainly I thought with a young rookie who may look to check the ball down when he's under pressure, that certainly seemed to kind of seem true or ring true that might happen, but it has not happened so far, and Miles Sanders has been a huge disappointment.
You know who has a higher yards per carry than Miles Sanders?
A lot of people.
Andy Dalton.
I'm going to say he's averaging 3.1. There's got to be a lot of people.
Andy Dalton!
As inefficient as Damian Pierce has been, I'm sure Damian Pierce is even averaging more yards per carry because I know he's higher than Miles Sanders in rushing success rate. Because, like I said, Miles Sanders is dead last.
Yeah, you know, Pierce Pierce has been hurt the most by the offensive line injuries because of the scheme that they run. And too often we're seeing Damian Pierce get hit. Like, he's getting the handoff and he's got to break a tackle.
Yeah, I also, you mentioned scheme. I also don't think, because he was obviously drafted by a previous coaching staff, I also don't think he fits what they're trying to do with the San Francisco zone scheme. He's more of a between the powers, between the tackle power runner. And, I mean, especially when they run toss plays to Damian Pierce. There was a game a few weeks ago where they were moving the ball, and all of a sudden they run a toss play to Damian Pierce, and what do you know, it's a three-yard loss. I think there's kind of there's definitely some growing pains, and Damian Pierce has even talked about it. He's not really fully comfortable yet in what they're asking him to do. Singletary's the better fit right now. I still think Pierce can learn it and get better, but right now Singletary's the better runner in this system.
So Pierce averaging 2.9 yards per carry.
Oh, he's worse than Sanders. Oh, my God.
However, he's also averaging negative 0.7 yards to initial contact.
That's not good. That's not ideal.
He averages being hit a yard behind the line of scrimmage.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's not going to get it done. I mean, that certainly would take some of the blame off of his shoulders for sure. Even guys like Christian McCaffrey are going to struggle if they're getting hit a yard in the backfield every carry.
There's only one Barry Sanders.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Barry Sanders would run himself into some huge losses.
But you think about how like that offense worked. Barry Sanders could have 14 carries for 10 yards,
uh-huh.
And then bang, 96 yards.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He was always getting hit behind the line and trying to break tackles, and you were just hoping for that one play where he'd bust it.
Yeah, go watch Barry Sanders' highlights on YouTube. See how many of them he's just clinging through the line. He's not. All the highlight plays are him juking 3-4 people in the backfield, spinning, turn around, going back and forth.
Until they got suddenly, in the red zone, and then it was time for touchdown Tommy Vardell.
All right, number four on my five reasons why the Texans will beat the Panthers this Sunday. The Panthers' defense, which was pretty good last season, has taken a pretty big step back. Right now they rank, down near the bottom in basically everything. They're 28th in defensive yards per play allowed, putting their offense in bad spots. They're 28th in yards per rush attempt allowed at 4.9, averaging, giving up 4.9 yards per carry. Hopefully Damian Pierce can take advantage of that. And along with that, and probably contributing to that, they have the second most missed tackles in the league. I don't think this Panthers defense is nearly as scary as it has been, and C.J. Stroud and company shouldn't have any problems on Sunday.
You know, not only to add on to that, this is going to be the first time I think the Texans are going to have essentially the same offensive line together for three games in a row.
Yeah, continuity is the big key there.
With Laramie Tunsil at left tackle. Titus Howard playing left guard because, well, we don't have a left guard right now. Mason, George Fant, and then the kid at center.
Patterson?
They're playing the same five for the third straight game. And you hope that, okay, as they're starting to get more reps together, the run game will start to be better because the one position on the field where everybody has to move in sync is the offensive line. Get the five biggest dudes you can.
Dancing
and
bears.
Get them to all do the exact same thing. So maybe as they continue to get more reps together, the running game, the holes will start to open up. Guys will start to know where to go. Like we've seen a lot of Damian Pierce not really like being hesitant where he's trying to be a patient runner, looking for a hole to open, and there's no hole. When they've been given the ball to Singletary, they're getting them out wide. They're using his speed. It's a different skill set. For Pierce, they've got to try to open something. Let him get to the second level and then start dropping his pad level and running guys over. And they haven't been able to do that yet. This might be the game where they finally get the running game on track.
I mean, certainly the defensive numbers would indicate, I think, that. Again, the Panthers allowing 4.9 yards per carry, 28th in the league. So, last one on the five reasons why the Texans will beat the Panthers this Sunday. You mentioned it earlier, but Frank Reich, after the 0-6 start, has now handed over play-calling duties to offensive coordinator Thomas Brown, who had an interview with the Houston Texans, people might remember. But Brown, part of the reason Frank Reich took on the play-calling to begin the season was Thomas Brown has never called plays in the NFL. He did call some plays in the preseason, a according to an article that I read earlier. But Thomas Brown, in this game against the Texans, will be calling offensive plays for the very first time in the NFL. So I think that is advantage Texans. If you're hiring D'Amico, whose superpower is being able to know what the offense does before they do it, and he's going up against a first-time play caller on the offensive side, D'Amico should crush that guy.
Well, maybe. I mean, are they going to have the best play calling of the year because it's finally not being done by Frank Reich?
I mean,
is Frank Reich going to...
You could argue that.
Is Frank Reich going to, you know, like, check him on everything? Like, okay, here's what I'm going to call. Okay, you can call that. Okay, here's what I'm going to call. No, you're not going
to
call that.
What you meant to call.
Yeah. What kind of play calling is this going to be?
I mean, everything I've read is Frank's handing it over, and he was just waiting. According to him, this... It was what came up at the press conference. It's like, no, this was not forced by the owner or the general manager, but this might be a little bit of, hey, you started 0-6. We're going to need to see some... You had the number one pick. You're 0-6. We need to see some changes.
So Frank was sitting, Yiner Diaz, and now that Altuve and Jordan are both hurt, being 0-6, now they're both hurt. Okay, now we're going to let you come in and get some time in the line. All right. Hey, we're 0-6. We blow. Our offense sucks. I'm going to let you call the plays now.
Yeah.
So that I can blame someone else.
Yeah, that way at the end of the season when they're 2-15, he can say, "Well, it was Thomas Brown's fault."
Look, the Texans should win this game. And they should win this game comfortably.
I mean, when was the last time they were road favorites? I can't remember all the time. Like,
they should win this game
probably
by at least a touchdown. Now they're on the road and they're still a very young team. The Panthers should be charged up for this game. Bryce Young should be charged up for this game. But I also think if the Texans get out to a quick lead, things could go downhill for Carolina real fast.
Yeah, this is a team now that at 0-6, I think it's one of those things when you start to lose a bunch, if things start to go poorly in a game, all those negative thoughts come back and kind of tend to snowball into a bad reaction to their early deficit.
I don't think they can move the ball fast enough.
Yeah, if the Texans get a big lead.
CJ can get out there and start slinging it.
Right.
I don't think the Panthers have the personnel to sling it. Where Nico Collins and Adam Thielen kind of have similar numbers. Nobody on the Panthers comes close to Tank Dell.
No, not even close.
Tank Dell will play this week.
It feels like if the Texans get to 24, the Panthers can't keep up. And it also feels like if the Texans get out to a big early lead, then this is a Panthers offense, as we mentioned throughout, you know, Bryce Young's numbers, no receivers behind Adam Thielen and Miles Sanders struggling this year. They don't have the offensive pieces to mount a comeback if the Texans get out to a big lead.
No, and we've also seen in recent weeks the emergence of Dalton Schultz in the passing game.
Yeah.
I think it's been huge.
You think that
for
continues? Because that was... Not such a coincidence. The Dalton Schultz breakout happened exactly when Tank Dell went down.
I think part of that is Schultz getting more comfortable in the system. I think part of that is we've seen... Look, CJ has gotten better in the system with each passing week. Like, it went from making his progressions to identifying the defense and finding the weaknesses in the defense at snap. CJ's progression this year is phenomenal.
I mean, that Falcons play where they threw the go-ahead touchdown against Dalton Schultz. CJ's talked about basically that was a play that he just kind of drew up and told Dalton Schultz what to do and had to explain it to him a couple times and told Bobby Slowick, hey, this is what we're going to do, and they ran it and obviously worked and got him the go-ahead touchdown.
I mean, that is why Peyton Manning is one of the greatest quarterbacks.
Yeah, exactly. That is Peyton Manning stuff for sure.
Peyton Manning would look at Marvin Harrison and say, you know, all right, do this, because he's identified, hey, this is where the weakness is in the defense, and Harrison could do the same thing. Eventually, he'd have the same relationship with Reggie Wayne, where they could identify the defense, both understand it.
Just give a look to each other. And
whatever
know exactly
I told in the huddle,
yeah.
Do that thing we talked about in practice, and bam, touchdown.
Yeah, and that's basically what C.J. Stroud talked about in the quote that he had about that play. He basically says he noticed something in film study about the way Falcons safety Jesse Bates was jumping certain routes and certain plays. So they drew one up to take advantage of his aggressiveness, and sure enough, Dalton Schultz beat him for 6.
I really want to see them get Hutch more involved.
He got involved in some of the like the reverse. Like he had a couple runs and a couple like screen passes, but
yeah, but he's only had two targets all year.
Yeah,
and you know, I don't know if John Metchie, you know, being his first year back from cancer treatment, he's necessarily fully up to speed because they don't seem to use him very much. I think we know who Noah Brown is, and he's not very good. If Metchie's not ready physically to handle, you know, playing 30, 40 snaps, give me more Hutch and less Noah Brown.
I mean, it might be still you know, a learning curve with Hutch, though. Obviously, he's a rookie and coming from kind of the spread offenses, the pass-happy Big 12. They might be having to learn more concepts than they ran there at Iowa State.
Those are five solid reasons, B-Mac. Nice
Thank
job
you.
On that.
Appreciate it.
All right, coming up next, one more segment to go. We'll hear from Todd Gallis, who joined the Killer Bees, had some very interesting things to say about the Astros and their pending manager search, and we'll get to those next.
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Dude.
Like I told my last wife, I says, honey, I never drive faster than I can see. Besides that, it's all in the reflexes.
Late night Houston sports talk only happens here. It's Late Hits with Patrick Creighton. Presented by Dr. Jennifer Joseph, Get Physical RX, by Dr. Krista Reyes, Texas Sinus and Snoring Audiology, and by MedUS. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, final segment, Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. And, you know, before we get into this final segment, let me tell you about our friends at Iron 24 Fitness and Recovery. You're looking for a gym, it's open 24 hours. No contracts, no hidden fees. It's Iron 24. You know, you want a place where you can sign up online on their app and not have to go through any of those sales pitches where they try to upsell you 100 different things and parade you around the gym on some stupid tour. No, you just want to get in and get to working out. Iron 24 Fitness and Recovery. Get everything you want from the high-caliber machines, free weights, infrared sauna recovery rooms. I mean, it's a great place to go and work out. Jeremy Branham's loving it. Jeremy Branham's at Iron 24, and it's actually got Jeremy in the gym. He's enjoying it. You'll enjoy it, too. Right now, as an ESPN listener, you can join up at Iron 24 and get 2 weeks for free and no sign-up fees. All you got to do is sign up on the app. Go to iron24.com/ESPN. That's iron24.com/ESPN. You can get signed up on the app. Get signed up today. Have access 24/7. You have access to all four Houston area locations. There are more that are opening very soon, but you have access to all four locations. You have all Iron 24 locations, 24/7 access anytime you want. No upcharge on that. Iron24.com/ESPN. Get started today. Iron 24 Fitness and Recovery. All right, Todd Gallis was on with the Bees earlier today, and obviously we know what he was talking about. He had a couple of interesting things to talk about. This one I thought was really good. This is Todd Gallis talking about how Dusty Baker, when he came in here, he had to overcome the scandal of everything that was going on with the sign stealing. And despite that, still had the most success in team history.
For those guys, James Click, Dana Brown, Dusty Baker, to come in behind the situation that happened after 2019, there was really nowhere for them to go but down. I mean, you're coming off of wild success in 17, 18, and 19. 19, obviously disappointing that they didn't win the World Series, but that was probably their best team in this seven-year run. But coming off of that year, you still had to get the job done. In a pandemic year, a lot of craziness happened. Dusty's such a big people person. He wasn't able to connect with his team and his team's families the way he wanted to, but they were still able to make it to Game 7 of the ALCS that year after a bad regular season. And then, obviously, the last 3 years, World Series appearance, and leading 3-2 coming back home and just missing on a World Series appearance this year. So, yeah, great success.
You know, and he's not wrong. He's not wrong on any of those things. That's why I said, you know, it's okay to disagree with the things that Dusty did this year and still appreciate the success of the team under his leadership, respect the career and the knowledge and the impact that he has had, and the fact that he brought them out of the scandal and took them to two different World Series, winning one of them. Like, it's still, it's okay to respect him and disagree with him at the same time. It doesn't have to be, well, he didn't do this. He's a moron. He sucks. He's stupid. We just disagree because Dusty's philosophies and some of our philosophies, especially if you are a big analytics type of person, or you bought into, you know, the Jeff Luhnow, A.J. Hinch, heavy analytics style that the Astros golden age started off in, to then go with a manager who is not heavy on analytics, you're going to have some, headbutting. But you know what? That doesn't mean there can't be respect there. Now, as far as the next manager, for some reason, people think that the Astros only, the Astros started to abandon analytics last year with the removal of James Click, which of course is idiotic. James Click, an analytics guy, Dana Brown, an analytics guy. The non-analytics guy was always the manager. But Todd said, Todd Gallo said he believes the next manager will blend traditional metrics and analytics as the Astros have always done.
Yeah, I mean, all the assistant GMs underneath Dana are super analytic guys. So, yeah, that's never going to go away. That'll always be a part of the DNA of the Astros because that's how they were built to have this incredible seven-year run. Is it less analytics now than maybe in the Luhnow era? I would say that you could probably make that case with Dana Brown now. Even James Click, he was more of a lean toward the analytics side. But it's always been a happy blend, right? Like Jeff Luhnow, as much as he's credited for being a numbers guy, it was also about finding the right players at the right time. And same with James Click, Dana Brown the same. So there's a very happy medium somewhere in between being a baseball lifer like Dana Brown is, understanding the numbers, and making the two blend themselves so that you find the best possible players. And the Astros have done as good a job as any of the other 29 teams in baseball the last 7 years doing that.
Now, you heard him talk about where they spent their money. Well, they spent money on their bullpen last year. They spent a lot of money on Rafael Montero. And as far as what you're looking at this year, Ryan Stanek's a free agent. Phil Maton's a free agent. Ektenaris has a player option he's expected to opt out of. Todd Gallo said he thinks only one of that group will be back.
They spent a lot of money last year with Rafael Montero, so that will be somewhat limiting in terms of how much they're going to spend on multiple names of that trio. I think Ektenaris of those three is probably going to command the biggest price just based on what he's done this year and based on what he's done in Philadelphia prior to coming here. But Maton and Stanek are going to get paid as well. They've been guys who have been reliable in the past in you know, arguably one of, if not the best bullpen in baseball the last two or three years. So they're all going to get paid. I would be shocked if all three of them came back. I would be surprised if two of them came back. So then you're prioritizing one of those three and trying to fill spaces with the others.
Now, I agree with you. I think only one of them comes back, and I think Maton is the one most likely to be back. I think Neris is looking for a bigger deal. It's going to price him out of the Astros want to do. Stanek's command issues, I think, are kind of turning the team off. We saw they didn't really use him in the postseason a year ago when they won the title. He had a much more diminished role in the bullpen this year. Maton took a step forward this year and pitched really well. And he's also a guy who doesn't make a lot of money. I think Maton could be the guy who winds up staying. As far as Michael Brantley, here's Todd Callis on Michael Brantley and what might be his future with the organization.
Michael Brantley, still we're not sure what's going to happen with him. It was an incredibly difficult year watching him trying to fight back and get back to being able to play late in the season, but not being able to play back-to-back games. And I'm just not sure where Michael is right now. I'm sure right now, you know, he's giving it some thought about whether he wants to keep grinding and working as hard as he did in 2023 to just play a limited number of baseball games and not really be himself fully healthy.
I think Michael Brantley will play baseball next year. I just don't think it'll be with the Astros. I think Brantley is going to wind up somewhere where he could DH more often than not and maybe play the field once or twice a week, if that. I think that he's going to look for a team that will let him DH the majority of the time. And look, that'll be the least wear and tear on his shoulder. But remember, he had that game where he made the big throw to home plate and played again for a week. So I think that that could be a big part of it. Here's the money question. Here's Todd Callis on Martin Maldonado.
For Maldi, I would be surprised if he left the game at this point. I don't know if that's going to be in an Astros uniform next year. I don't know if that's going to be in another uniform next year. I do think, you know, with Dana Brown as the GM, he wants to see Yiner Diaz get some more playing time. So whether Maldi stays here or not, I think there's probably a shifting of the power behind the plate, and you're going to see Yiner start to trend towards being the number one catcher, which he wasn't in 2023, obviously.
I think one of the big things on whether or not Martin Maldonado will be back is whether or not he is willing to accept playing once a week. Is Maldi willing to accept being the backup and, you know, being more of a mentor to Yiner Diaz and less of an everyday player? Because he wasn't ready or willing to do that this year. And it's hindering the growth of Yiner, and it's hindering the team.
The other part of that, though, is Verlander and Fromber, or maybe Javier, are those guys willing to accept? Like, if you bring Maldi back, aren't you kind of setting up a situation where JV and Fromber could walk into the clubhouse and say, we're pitching to Martin Maldonado, and then we're right back where we started?
And look, that's part of it, right, is you can't have and this is allegedly, because it's not like those guys have come out in public and said, I'm only going to throw to one catcher. So we're talking about allegedly behind closed doors. There's no tape recording of this. Maldi is a respected veteran on the team. He is considered one of the leaders on the team. But if you have to let him go so that you can groom your young catcher who might hit 35 home runs next year, look, you can go get a defense-first backup catcher. They're a dime a dozen. And Maldi's defensive metrics this year were bloody awful.
Yeah, think about Game 7 when the Rangers stole, what, three bases in the first two innings?
Well, I can't necessarily put a lot of blame on that on him because
Javier was slow to the plate.
Christian Javier is the slowest to the plate.
But
I mean,
still,
he's among the slowest to the plate in baseball.
Things that people will try on this version of Maldi at age 36, they will not try on Yiner Diaz.
No, because Diaz is a cannon. You know, Diaz showed you he's got an absolute rocket for an arm, and teams, look, they paid the price for that. The league average on caught stealing was like 20%, and he finished at 31%. And part of that was a couple of late steals because he didn't have a whole lot of guys attempting to steal on him. As word got around, hey, this guy will cut you down. Guys stopped running on him. So teams were looking for, okay, which pitcher is really slow? Most stolen bases come off the pitcher than the catcher. You're looking for a catcher who can kind of overcome that. Right now, Yiner can. Maldi can't. Maldi's just going to be 37 years old. So, like I said, I think you can go find a defensive catcher. They're easy to find. It's time to turn the reins over. And if that means saying goodbye to Martin Maldonado, then it's time to say goodbye to Martin Maldonado and, you know, wish him well in his future endeavors, just like you did Dusty Baker. It's going to do it for us for tonight. Back on Monday at 6 o'clock, Joe George and I will have the 6 o'clock hour Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday before World Series games that will be airing here on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Appreciate Brian McDonald on the other side of the glass. Our texters, tweeters, and twitchers. See you next week. Have a great weekend. H-Town!
ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Watch out, door.
I will not be murdered wearing a blue and white plastic cone on my head. It's positively undignified.